This episode is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Radio Meters program.
Hello, you are tuned into Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territory of the Musqueam people at UBC. My name is Alirad Amari, and I'm joined by my co-host today, Gurman Gill. Each week on Research Review, we interview a researcher who is affiliated with the UBC community and discuss some of their latest work and findings and how they relate to broader issues in society. Welcome, Dr. Jess McIver, to Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM. Dr. McIver is an assistant professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at UBC. Dr. McIver earned a PhD in physics from the University of Massachusetts and also did a postdoc at Caltech before coming to UBC in 2019. She is also a principal investigator at UBC LIGO, Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory.
Oh, you did great. You did very well with that. Sometimes people say LIGO, like the toy, but it's LIGO.
Excellent. So, Just tell us a little bit about yourself, like your educational background and just how you arrived at where you are right now.
Well, let's see. I think I applied to college as a linguistics major. I kind of always wanted to be a writer, and then physics really caught my interest. So I have a bachelor's degree in physics and also one in writing, so in magazine journalism, which, let me tell you, that really comes in handy. I feel like now as a professor, I'm pretty much a professional writer, always communicating about my research, writing grants, writing papers. So if there's anyone out there listening, thinking about a career in science, invest in writing. It's a really good use of time.
That's definitely like what I noticed is that, so I saw you did your bachelor's of science in both physics and journalism back in New York, and just wondering, like, doing both physics and journalism, I guess, what motivated you to go into physics for grad school and further on instead of the journalism side of things?
That's such a good question, and I think it was the research that I was doing when I was a student. So I was an undergraduate student at Syracuse University in upstate New York, as you said, and I had this class that I loved. It was astronomy. We called it Astronomy 300. It was sort of galaxies and stars. And the professor was so enthusiastic, and it really just captured my imagination. So he encouraged us all to get involved with research as well, which is very good advice if you're thinking about, you know, pursuing science as a career. So I knocked on his office door and I said, I would like to do research with you. Whatever it is that you're doing, I'll do that. You know, whatever makes you so happy to be coming to work every day. So it turns out he was doing gravitational waves and I had never heard of them before. You know, I thought they were totally wild. The idea of these tiny little fluctuations in space-time being able to convey this information. But it really captured my attention so much that not only did I decide to apply to graduate schools, but I pretty much only applied to graduate programs that had LIGO as a research option. So that carried me through to graduate school and then beyond. And this was all way before we found gravitational waves. So this is, I think I was one of the last PhD theses to defend before we detected gravitational waves. So all the way through to the PhD without having any data that contains real gravitational wave signals.
Yeah, it must be crazy to try to pursue a career in something that was never actually directly detected yet.
Yeah, you know, it always kind of felt like we were right on the precipice, you know? So there's very, very strong evidence that gravitational waves exist from the Hulse-Taylor binary pulsar. So general relativity predicts that when you've got two compact objects like black holes or neutron stars and they're in an orbit, that as they orbit around each other, they're going to be slowly radiating away energy in the form of gravitational waves. So this should spin their orbit up. They should get closer and closer together over time. And this was first observed decades before we directly detected gravitational waves. But you can see the orbits, the frequency of it, just follow exactly the curve that general relativity predicts. So that was That was a Nobel Prize, I think, in 1993 for the Hulse-Taylor binary.
Maybe could you introduce us to like the UBC LIGO group, what kind of work you guys do there, and just maybe LIGO in general?
Sure. So maybe a good place to start is gravitational waves. So we might make the analogy with radio. So thinking about, you know, to use radio waves to communicate. So we use some kind of a microphone to transform them into radio waves that are broadcast. And then we build some kind of a transducer. So this might be your antenna on your car. So I usually am in my car when I'm listening to the radio. And these are our similar to our gravitational wave detectors. There's some transducer that transforms gravitational waves into some kind of signal. So for your car antenna, this transforms it into some data that you could feed right into your speakers, and that turns them into sound waves that you can hear. For us, we can feed that data in. We can also transform it into sound waves. So we can actually listen to gravitational waves, and you may have heard them before. There are some really nice clips on the LIGO Laboratory media gallery site. But we build these transducers to help us to sense what are essentially really tiny fluctuations in the fabric of space-time. So they're very weakly interacting, which makes them really tricky to detect, but it also means that they don't really interact with other matter. It's really difficult for them to be obfuscated by anything, including the Earth. So I would call myself an astrophysicist, maybe even an astronomer or an aspiring astronomer, but I don't care if it's day or night. So the gravitational waves are gonna pass right through the Earth. They're gonna pass through galaxies and dust and pretty much anything else that they encounter and still give me that crystal clear signature of what it was that produced them.
Now, you mentioned these waves are detected in a way, right?
Yes. That's right.
So just out of curiosity, random question, but where are these detectors located and how big are they?
Oh my goodness, that's such a good question. So they are, one of them is quite close to Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So it's about a 5-hour drive. It's just over the border in the US in the desert in Washington State.
Oh,
and it's called LIGO Hanford. So this is an important site for some of the Manhattan Project testing. And then the other LIGO detector is in Louisiana, so quite a bit further away in the US. And there are a network of them around the world. So there's also a sister detector called Virgo in Italy, and a cryogenic underground detector in Japan called Kagra, and then a third LIGO detector that's being built in India. And all of them are really enormous in scale, so kilometers long. So the LIGO detectors are all 4 kilometers long. So that's two arms that are each perpendicular to each other and 4 kilometers long. So it's 8 total kilometers of enclosed vacuum, plus a bit at the ends for the instrumentation that it takes to insert laser lights into these really long vacuum tubes and to sense the output of the gravitational wave detector. So yeah, it takes really quite a lot of land.
Oh, wow. So would you say, you know, your team, when you're doing research, do you, for example, like travel down to Washington to go to the detector, or is the information sort of like remotely accessed?
Well, a bit of both. So if the border were open and we weren't in the middle of a pandemic,
yeah,
we would certainly be going down there, I guess. So the data does flow. So there is essentially what you might think of. Yeah, I think our analogy for radio is really quite good. So it's a similar kind of time series that you can record and then you can stream it, which is essentially what we do. So we can stream the data from the detectors to these other sites that also we'll make copies, we'll do analysis, we'll try to sift through that time series and look for patterns that match what we're expecting to see for gravitational wave signals. But it can be really helpful to be at the detectors to do noise studies and detector characterization, which is one thing that the UBC LIGO group specializes in.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, would all the LIGO detectors be detecting the exact same thing, or is there a reason why we have multiple around the world?
That's, again, very good question. So our detectors, coming back to our sound wave analogy, so our detectors are like microphones in the sense that we are sensitive to most of the sky. So sort of like putting a microphone in an empty room, you can pick up most of what's coming from the room, provided your signal to noise is high enough. But it's really tough with just one microphone to tell where exactly in the room the sound is coming from. So gravitational wave detectors are the same. It takes multiple detectors to tell where in the sky the signal is coming from. So two will get you a ring around the sky. Three will get you, well, we can do a little bit better than 2 points with our triangulation. We can usually get it down to centered around 1 point in the sky if we have a good enough signal to noise ratio. The more detectors you have, the better your sky resolution is going to be, and also the better able you are to distinguish between signal and noise. Because like a microphone in a crowded room, there's a lot of other chatter that's coming from features that are here on Earth that have nothing to do with gravitational waves.
Interesting. You mentioned features on Earth, and random question that just popped into my head. So technical feasibility aside, imagine you could build a LIGO detector on another planet, like let's say on Mars. Would that be useful or not?
Yeah, again, a really good question. So you might have seen in the news lately that there are some mysterious seismic fluctuations that some of these rovers are detecting. So it would help to a point. It would help to not have traffic and trains and trucks and birds. We've got a lot of good stories about birds. We have a lot of trouble with birds. And, you know, cell phones, and there are a lot of things that, yes, it would help quite a lot with, but fundamentally, there is still that lower limit where at very, very low frequencies, just this very, very slow shaking of the ground, you would still see that on other planets that are a little bit seismically active.
Interesting.
So we have to, yeah, we have to go into space, which is what we're doing with LISA, the Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. So that's a similar kind of technology. You're using laser interferometry to essentially make a different kind of attenuator, but kind of coming back to your car antenna analogy. So your car antenna, to detect radio waves, you want to make it a certain length to optimize your signal. And that's based on the wavelength of the electromagnetic radiation you're receiving, the radio wavelength. So for LISA, instead of 4 kilometer long arms, they're going to be 2.5 million kilometer long arms. And this is optimized to detect these much, much lower frequency gravitational waves.
Interesting.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Things like supermassive black holes.
Great. We'll be back here on Research Review after just one short message. So please stay tuned.
According to the BC Centre for Disease Control, symptoms of coronavirus disease 2019, or COVID-19, may develop after 2 to 14 days of exposure. Common symptoms are fever, cough, and shortness of breath. Call your doctor if you are experiencing these symptoms. Emergency signs of COVID-19 are difficulty breathing or shortness of breath, persistent pain or pressure in chest, new confusion or inability to arouse, and bluish lips or face. This is not an exhaustive list. Go to the emergency room if you are experiencing these symptoms.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. We are back here on Research Review. I'm Ali Rodden, along with my co-host Gurman. Today we are interviewing Dr. Jess McIver. Dr. McIver is an assistant professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at UBC. So far, we've talked a bit about LIGO, which is the Laser Interferometer or Gravitational Wave Observatory. So, Gurman, I think you had a question for Dr. McIver.
Yeah, one question I had is, I know how having multiple LIGO detectors can maybe help distinguish from local traffic on Earth, but I would assume that what we're detecting is galaxies away and super small, and things need to be super sensitive. How can you get rid of all that noise from, say, like other planets and other stars and anything else in between?
That's a really good question. So you're absolutely right that the signal is extremely weak, and therefore the sensitivity of the detectors is really almost unimaginably small. So we're so sensitive to relative changes in length. We're essentially trying to sense this relative stretching and squeezing of space-time. So you're measuring how long it takes the light to travel down 1 4-kilometer arm relative to the 4-kilometer arm in a perpendicular direction. That's essentially the general idea. And we're looking for signals that are on the order of 10,000 times smaller than the diameter of a proton. Just really almost unimaginably small. So as you can imagine, it really doesn't take much, especially here on Earth, to move the mirrors around just a little bit so that we can introduce this noise that can overwhelm our ability or even mimic signals in a way that we might mistake them for gravitational waves. So having that degeneracy, having those multiple different detectors around the Earth really helps with this, because you're exactly right what you said earlier. You would expect to see the same kind of signal propagating through what we would call coherently. So you'd expect to see, sort of like if you broadcast a sound wave from some point in the room, if you know how far apart your microphones are, then you would expect to be able to track exactly what that sound wave would, how that would appear in each one of your different microphones. So that's a really good way that we can distinguish between signal and noise. And we also work really hard to understand our noise. So to really try and see what kinds of effects are contributing to our ability to sense gravitational waves and how we can keep pushing that noise floor down.
What kind of objects do you usually really study with the UBC LIGO group? I know black holes seems to be the main example that tends to be brought up in these sorts of conversations. Is that basically all you're studying, or is there, what else are you studying?
Yeah, so we're at a really exciting time with gravitational wave astronomy right now, in that we're just starting to see sources, and these are sources that we would not have been able to detect otherwise, these stellar mass black hole binaries that are dark. So you wouldn't be able to see them with a telescope. So it's not surprising in a lot of ways that these are the first kinds of signals that we're seeing, but we do expect to see gravitational waves from other sources. And the UBC LIGO group is looking, actively contributing to the search for other sources. So we have a research associate, Evan Getz, here in the UBC LIGO group, who is one of the co-leaders of the group that's looking for these really long duration sources from spinning neutron stars. And these are really interesting because gravitational waves could allow us to decode this neutron star equation of state. So essentially, what is the structure of a neutron star and how much asymmetry can it support? And this asymmetry is what's encoded in the gravitational wave of a spinning neutron star. We're also helping in the search for gravitational waves from really novel sources like quark collapse supernovae. So that would be a particularly rich treasure trove where you might expect to see electromagnetic radiation. So in the form of the supernova, you'd expect to see potentially gravitational waves if the signal is close enough to the Earth, and then potentially also neutrinos. So you'd really get this broad, rich, multi-messenger source of multiple different signals from the same source. There are also searches ongoing in the LIGO collaboration for this stochastic background. This might be from the Big Bang, or it might be this kind of popcorn collective signature of these individually irresolvable mergers, this kind of a background of really, really distant mergers. So we're not as directly involved in that search, but we do search for continuous waves, what we call compact object mergers. This is black holes and neutron stars, like you were saying, what we call bursts, or particularly supernova sources. And then we're embedded kind of right at the intersection between the astrophysics and the instruments. So thinking about calibrating the data, thinking about improving the detector performance.
Now, one question that I have, and perhaps our listeners may have, you know, because it's... So we hear the term black hole a lot, and I was just wondering, what exactly is a black hole, and are they really black in color, or is that just a term that's used to describe them?
That's, again, yeah, great question. So I think it makes the most sense to me to think about black holes in terms of space-time. And so maybe we'll start there. So space-time, you have our three-dimensional space where you can, you know, you can move around, you can go up or down or left or right or front to back or whatever combination of those three dimensions. And then we weave that together with time where you can only go forward. So time marches forward, and then for each moment in time, you're stitching into that this three-dimensional space where any object can move through it. And this is the space-time that we say curves in the presence of matter. So mass in particular. So let's say I have some star, and my star is born from some accreted gas and ignites, and it goes through its life cycle until finally it runs out of fuel to burn and then collapses into maybe a black hole. So I would call that black hole quintessentially in its essence this extremely curved space-time. So it's essentially generating this curvature of space-time, which we'd experience as gravity if we were, say, orbiting around the black hole the same way as we might a star of equivalent mass. But it's got this much more extreme curvature. And it does actually appear, so let's say if we're astronauts and we're orbiting around a black hole, it would actually appear black in the sense that there would be this absence of light. So if we're, let's say, outside of the event horizon, so this is the point of no return for anything, including light, what we're going to see is the light that's coming from behind the black hole, so maybe other stars and galaxies, that's going to be getting bent. And we're going to be seeing this ring around the black hole, and this is all of the warped, bent light that's coming into the black hole and not exiting it anymore. So it would indeed appear black, and you can actually see this from some of the first images taken by the Event Horizon Telescope. I think the first one of those came out 2 years ago now, over the summer. These really remarkable images where you can see that contrast, the darkness in the black hole and then the event horizon outside of it.
And just the one thing again about the black hole. So I saw there was some coverage in some news sources such as Global News last September 2020 that your team discovered a black hole that was so-called a mid-sized black hole as opposed to say a compact or full-size black hole. And what are the implications of discovering such a new size of black hole, this like mid-size? What would make this so like interesting?
Oh yeah, so what we've been able to uncover with light is that we do have this expectation that stars that die will form, they'll either directly collapse into black holes or they'll explode in a supernova. And we sort of have a maximum limit just based on what we understand about the physics of stars. And also an observation up till now, anyway, so with light, with electromagnetic radiation, we'd only ever seen black holes up to a certain mass. And that was actually fairly low. That was only actually about 20 times the mass of our sun. So gravitational wave astronomy has really uncovered this totally different population of black holes that are much bigger, much more massive. And some of those we do expect. So you can certainly model a star that collapses into a black hole, let's say 50 times the mass of our sun, or even maybe 60 times the mass of our sun. But we expected to see essentially this gap, what we would call the pair instability supernova gap, between essentially the maximum observed stellar mass black hole and something that's maybe a bit larger. So the most interesting lower limit to compare that to is something like the supermassive black hole that you might see at the center of the Milky Way. So these much, much larger black holes that do kind of lurk in the middle of galaxies. There was, up until that discovery last fall, really nothing in between. Something that would have come from the death of a star or something that would be at the center of a galaxy. So we call those stellar mass black holes and supermassive black holes. And what was discovered is an intermediate mass black hole that was over 100 times the mass of our sun. So something that really wasn't that was not expected. We can't explain it through the evolution of a star, but we might be able to explain it as the product of a prior merger. So this is telling us a new story now about how many black holes there are in space, how many there are in binaries, how often they collide. So we're really learning a lot about this very dynamic part of the universe that's totally in the dark. So we're really not able to access it with telescopes. And we're getting this new insight with gravitational waves, and we're learning something totally new, and that is pretty exciting.
Cool. Thanks for sharing that. We'll be right back here on Research Review, CITR 101.9 FM, after just one short message, so please stay tuned.
Without the help and support of our friends, we here at CITR wouldn't be able to bring you all the great music, art, cinema, and culture that you love. Thanks to the long-standing support from the Rio Theater, we are able to keep you informed on all the great artists, films, and everything else coming to town there. For all the current information about who and what's playing at the Rio Theater, visit their website at www.riotheater.ca.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from the UBC Vancouver campus. And we are back here on Research Review. My name is Alrad, and along with my co-host Gurman, today we're interviewing Dr. Jess McIver. So in the past bit, we talked a bit about black holes, what exactly those are, and we also talked a bit about Dr. McIver's team and how they recently discovered a mid-sized black hole, and a bit about the implications of that. So going forward, Gurman, you have something to bring up.
Yeah. On top of black holes, I know you also mentioned neutron stars, and I vaguely remember reading a bit about them in high school. From what I understand, they are super dense, and they have something to do with heavy metals. Could you maybe elaborate or correct on that?
So this is a discovery that many of the UBC LIGO group members contributed to before we were at UBC, myself included. So there's a discovery in 2017 of gravitational waves from a binary neutron star merger that was the first example of multi-messenger astronomy with gravitational waves, because we detected a gravitational wave signal. 1 second later, there was also this gamma ray that registered in gamma ray satellites orbiting outside of the Earth. And then also about 12 hours later, I think, was this kilonova detection, this afterglow of this merger. And the afterglow is this telltale signature of this heavy metal generation. So essentially, you've got these two neutron stars, they're tearing each other apart, they're making this really neutron-rich, dense environment that you can, that essentially this is what we now think is the primary mechanism by which we build up really heavy elements. So in order to make a heavy atom, so something that's got maybe, say, more protons than maybe even iron, you might think of that, but to get all the way up to gold and platinum, some of these really much heavier elements, you need this incredibly neutron-rich environment. And we used to think, maybe even 10 years ago, or maybe even 5 years ago, that supernovae were one of the main drivers of how we produce heavy elements. You might have heard of the expression, we're all star stuff. And that's sort of where that concept came from, is that, you know, the heavy elements are forged in as the star is dying and then scattered throughout the universe. But it turns out, thanks to what we're learning with gravitational waves, we now have the sense that maybe this is actually binary neutron stars that are colliding and generating these heavy elements and scattering them throughout the universe.
Yeah, that seems really cool. So, like, say the gold in, like, my pocket watch would come from a neutron star.
Yeah, well, not even just a neutron star. A neutron star that collided and got torn apart and then, yeah, generated gold that got flung in our direction. Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. I can see how studying gravitational waves could be useful on top of other detection methods like radio and electromagnetic light. What are maybe like some of the implications of having another way of detecting things in our galaxy? What more could we learn?
Well, you know, I think a lot of the power in gravitational waves is actually extragalactic. So everything we've detected so far has been very distant. And one of the contrasts with electromagnetic astronomy, so that includes gamma rays and x-rays and radio waves and optical light. So when you're using a telescope, you're counting photons in some area. You're using some kind of a photodetector. So the strength of your signal is going to fade as 1/distance squared between you, the observer, and your source. Whereas gravitational waves, we've got this attenuator that's essentially converting directly the signal strength, the amplitude, to some kind of a signal that we can read out. So that means that our signal strength is going to fade as 1/distance. So we've got that essentially extra factor of distance, which means that we can sense these sources much, much farther away in many cases. So we're seeing black holes colliding, you know, gigaparsecs away, just these really incredibly vast distances. And we're getting a much more complete picture of how stars are dying, you know, when in time they're dying. So how have the stars evolved over time, and also as a function of this is also, you can think about this as a function of distance from the Earth as well. So putting this in terms of redshift, so how far back in cosmic time corresponds to how far away they are. But I think one of the most exciting things about gravitational waves is that with this new messenger, we could sense something that we're not expecting. Sort of like looking through a telescope for the first time, there might be something out there that's emitting gravitational waves that we've never conceived of before. So these detectors really unlock that possibility.
And this something, it could be anything. It could be like...
It could be anything moving. So gravitational wave detectors, yes. So when we're generating these ripples in space-time, it's sort of like throwing a stone into a pond. It takes this, some kind of a dynamic change to generate these gravitational waves. So as a physicist, I call this a quadrupole moment. But really what I mean when I say that is this asymmetry. So there's got to be some asymmetry and some acceleration to generate gravitational waves. And it has to be really incredibly massive and high speed in order to generate gravitational waves that will propagate over gigaparsecs. So, you know, really things on the order of, you know, tens of times the mass of our sun, you know, going at some significant fraction of the speed of light. Is these are the kinds of sources that we're seeing in our gravitational wave detectors.
Yeah, I can't do the math in my head, but how long ago would those gravitational waves be generated then?
Yeah, that's a good question. So let's see. So I think a good example is the very, very first detection of gravitational waves. So this was, if I'm remembering right, something like 400 megaparsecs away, which is about 1.4 billion light years away. So it would have...
Wow.
So those two, yeah.
1.4 billion years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, we're seeing that snapshot in cosmic time that passes through the Earth.
So could this take us all the way back to like the Big Bang and learn more about that?
So we are thinking about building bigger detectors that will take us to what we call the cosmic dawn. So this is essentially the beginning of star formation. So it's possible that when we build those bigger detectors, we will see this strong stochastic kind of a echoing remnant of the Big Bang. We don't really have a good, well-converged model of what that should look like, how those gravitational wave remnants of the Big Bang might be propagating. So it's possible. We certainly could. There are some cosmic microwave background experiments like BICEP that are looking for these types of signatures that are really, really at the lower frequency ends. But it's for signals that we expect to see, like black hole binaries, we do expect eventually to be able to build detectors here on Earth on the scale of tens of kilometers, so something like 10 to 40 kilometers long, that should be able to see all the way to the beginning of this stellar archaeology record.
Wow. It's a lot of stuff.
Yes, and it's really difficult to dig back that far with telescopes because you have so much else in between. So to be able to really get that crisp, clear signature of something that's essentially evolving a really, really long time ago effectively is going to be a totally new view of the early universe.
Now, just to say, you know, when you're using a telescope, is this sort of like a camera? So imagine, you know, for example, like right now, well, our listeners can't see this, but there is a microphone in front of me, so that's basically like blocking the view of my face. So would a telescope be similar if there's something in front of that, basically you wouldn't be able to see it in a way?
Yeah. So, well, you'd at least expect some distortion. Mm-hmm. So, for example, dust can distort images that travel for a long distance before reaching Earth. But astronomers also use this in really clever ways. So astronomers will use sort of background sources to study something that's in the foreground, like dust, or using the principle of general relativity, where we expect light to be bent around curved space-time to look for dark matter. So astronomers are really very clever about thinking about what's in their foreground and what's in their background.
Great. We'll be back here on Research Review after just one short message, so please stay tuned.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from UBC's Vancouver campus. And we are back here on Research Review. Today we are interviewing Dr. Jess McIver. And just, unless German, do you have any questions to ask?
Yeah, I had one that was just off the top of my head. It's just something from grade 9. I remember hearing about this theoretical particle called a graviton, which, from my understanding, is a theoretical gravity particle, like a photon is a light particle. Mm-hmm. So how would that work in relation to your work? And, yeah, can you maybe tell us a bit more about what that could look like?
Sure. Well, it's tough for us to set limits on gravitons with the detectors as we currently have them. So kind of like a photon, you're expecting your photon to have some properties based on the wavelength of the light. So similarly, we have gravitational waves with a much, much longer wavelength than our detector has. So it's tough for us to put really solid constraints on it. But that's exactly right in terms of the concept. It's the quantization of gravitational waves, just as the photon is the quantization of a light wave.
Hmm. Also, one last thing. I was looking on your website earlier this morning, and I saw something called gravityspy.org.
Yeah.
And I was on that website for a little bit. I thought it was a little cool. Maybe could you tell the viewers a bit more about that?
Yes. So if you're looking for something to do in the pandemic, Gravity Spy is the right citizen science project for you. So this actually intersects really well with the work that the UBC Lego Group does in particular. So the project is very cool. So we rely on citizen scientists to classify our noise. So we get all kinds of blips and boops, and we have funny names for them sometimes. A fun fact about our Tom T. glitch is this is named after a Swedish gnome's hat. You'll see why if you Google Tom T. But this is really limiting for us in terms of how far out into space we're able to sense these sources. So what we do is we compile the citizen scientists' classifications into a training set And that training set gets fed into a convolutional neural net, which classifies all of our noise sources. And this is a really, really powerful way for us to understand and to mitigate our noise. And we do have some weird things in the data. So it's certainly worth having a look, seeing if you can help us out. We definitely have had citizen science users make discoveries about the noise that we've actually been able to fix in the detector and improve the data.
Okay, so it's sort of like training AI to detect the noise on its own.
It's a little bit of both. So some of the really most helpful discoveries have been made directly by the citizen scientists who have reported them in the chat function. And you can even see examples of this in our electronic log, where some of our Gravity Spy users are credited with finds. But yes, in a broad sense, any contribution you can make is helpful because it'll all get fed into this training set that we'll use to classify all of our noise sources broadly over the course of a run. But this only works for classes we're expecting. And it's really the citizen scientists we rely on to flag these new noise sources that don't really match any of our other classes.
And just before we wrap things up, one last question just about the LIGO groups in general, because I can see that there are LIGO groups at other universities as well. And there was also one at Caltech. Is the one at Caltech like the original LIGO group or the main one?
Yes, so this is a useful distinction to make. So there's a really broad array of research happening at the UBC LIGO group. So there's the astronomy side, which I told you a bit about. There's also this really cool effort to do research and development for material science that we'll need to build those longer baseline detectors that we were talking about. So right now we're really limited by this jittering noise at the surface of the coatings. So these coatings have to be really highly reflective, but essentially the relative distance measurement that we're making is so small that even down at the atomic level, if you have that jittering around, that's going to interfere with the measure that we're making. So the Quantum Matter Institute at UBC also has a really strong team that's helping us develop these new materials that we're going to need to sense even further out into space. And there are a lot of LIGO groups like UBC's around the world that tackle this problem from very, very different ends of the spectrum, very different challenges that we all need to solve together in order to be able to make progress. And there are well over 1,000 members of the LIGO Scientific Collaboration. So this is over 100 different institutions, more than 20 countries. And we all work together to help build, characterize the LIGO detectors, analyze the data, work with our counterparts at Virgo and Kagra. And the LIGO detectors themselves are run by Caltech and MIT. Mm-hmm. That's called the LIGO Laboratory.
So even the one in Washington State is run by Caltech and MIT.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Interesting. Very cool.
Yeah. I think this is a good place to wrap things up. It was a pleasure having you on. I definitely learned quite. Yeah. Hopefully you did inspire a few English students to switch to astrophysics. Who knows?
Yeah, I hope so.
Yeah, I definitely learned a lot. It was a pleasure having you on. It was nice to meet you.
This has been Research Review on CITR 101.9 FM.